of view, I said intellectual honesty once, but it shows you where we're at, that and this is recording too? Mm-hmm. Okay, and they're both going, you've checked.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, we can begin. It's Monday, the 28th of January, 2013. And once again, I say hello to my dear students in front of me and all those listening around the world, and from all the correspondents coming in, I see that many are listening. Anyway, I just want to mention to you that a student, Chaim Snitzer, sent me pictures from the Eldridge Synagogue. Someone described it. Here's a picture. And you see one of the tzedakah boxes from 120 years ago. One of the tzedakah boxes is Yeshivat Eitz Chaim. And then as far as the spittoons, believe it or not, here's a spittoon on display from the Eldridge Synagogue. So you see, I wasn't playing games with you. Joe Lookstein, I think I have it in Washington, but I will never forget Joe Lookstein yelling and shouting at us. What a battle I had to get rid of the spittoons in Kehillat Jeshurun. Yashar Koyach, by the way, and what you gave me, I'll read it with interest. Also, I want to mention, if you recall, I said to you that one of the big problems about coming to America is that anyone can claim anything. In Israel, you all know that in order, when I started teaching here, I had to go to the Masrat HaChinuch, and I had to get accreditation, and I had to bring proof that I have all my degrees. And over the ocean, how do you bring proof? And I said, 120 years ago, anyone could say anything and go and prove it. Following the Holocaust, it was also very similar. So a student of mine in West Hempstead, Josh Schneider, whose father was basically my classmate, sent me information about his grandfather, how his grandfather was a shochet in Bodek, came from Europe to Mexico, from Mexico came to the United States, and from Mexico to America, he lost all his documents. So he went to Big Rabbanim in New England, and they wrote to Europe, and the people who knew him from Europe and had given him Kabbalah to be a sheikh, etc., sent back another document, and here's a letter from Rabbi Yehuda Leib Feuer telling us that he also tested him, and he's an absolute reliable sheikh of Bodek. But the underlying story is that they went through the trouble of contacting Europe, and there I guess you could do it. It's not the Holocaust, and if you really wanted to, you could prove who you were. Finally, just one additional comment before we roll. My eulogy for Stan Musial, it seems I was not the only one in the world to give a eulogy for Stan Musial, and all the way from Cardinals, I got correspondence from all over the world, from Cardinals to the president of the RCA, or should it be the opposite way, Sam? What do you say? From the president of RCA, Shmuel Golden, to Cardinals. And Shmuel Golden gave a whole drasha that his father called him Stanley, but he never liked the name Stanley. He always used Shmuel, but he says one message he got out of Stanley: stand the man usual, and you got to be a man. And all my years in learning Torah and in the rabbinate, I tried to emulate Stan the man. So I say I wasn't the only one to touch upon the drasha, but the most important part is here's a man who was happily married to his wife of his youth, who died a few months before him, Lillian, 72 years. And this is what's so important. My daughter, my eldest daughter, said it to me last night in a different context, that you all know she's the first Tohenet in the history of our people. And unfortunately, she has a very big practice. Why do I say unfortunately? It's like you wish a doctor. What do you say to a doctor? You should have a big practice. Chas v'chalila, we want the doctor to go out of business, but yet you got to wish him well. So you say, no one should be sick. But if anyone is sick, you should be the shliach from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Same thing with my daughter. No one should get divorced. But if anyone does get divorced, you should handle the case. So my daughter told me Shabbos morning, she met a lady in shul. She had, because my youngest grandson, Lane, he's a fabulous Baal Korei. So he walks quite a way to lane in the shul. I think it's once a month he lanes, to have a whole rotation. So my daughter walked with him, daven there, and she's sitting next to this woman that was very upset, and my daughter got to talk with her after davening, and it seems she just got up shiva from her husband. And he was in Machal. He was a pilot in Israel, an Englishman, and then took years. They came back and settled here, and they were married over 60 years. And my daughter says, you have to let people know that you had a wonderful marriage, because the youth today doesn't understand it. So I told my daughter, I said the same thing about Stan Musial, what you said, Shabbos. Okay, let's roll. That's the Mili de Badichata. Yitzchak, thank you for your compliment yesterday. But one has to be intellectually honest. And I have to tell you, I'm not certain I'm 100% right. In other words, this is the way I view the Rebbe and understand him. But remember, I spoke with the Rebbe in 83. I heard his jokes about Professor Liebman in the 50s. But I didn't speak with the Rebbe in 1920s. You follow me? All right, I rely upon my interviews with the students of Rabbi Chiel Yaakov. But nevertheless, the other point of view could also be true to a certain degree. You understand what I'm saying? They don't automatically exclude one the other. But it's an interesting point, and 200 years from now, whoever writes the definitive biography of the Rebbe will have to make an intelligent, you know, decision which way to go. Whether he's right or wrong, we can't always be right. People always think, you know, a Rebbe has vision. So people say to me, what's going to happen in the elections? I always answer, it's hard enough for me to predict the past. You want me to predict the future? Oh, no. Okay, now, Reitz, we're coming into a very important understanding of what happened. The students at Reitz wanted to broaden. The story of 1907 that I told you with Solomon Schechter really is, when you think of it, you shake. Because if Solomon Schechter had accepted Rabbi Rachman's father, David Rachman, and Rabbi Nathan Eben, we'll come back to Rabbi Eben next year, these become very important rabbis. And the third student, Rabbi Wolf, and we don't know what happened to him. And it's not that I don't know, I never did the research, but Rabbi Klapman, who did his doctorate, doesn't know who he was really. Had he and Solomon Schechter accepted them, you may not be sitting here today. Could it very well be that JTS would be where we'd be sitting, and JTS would be an Orthodox institution. It could be, but you know, if is the biggest word in the dictionary. But Solomon Schechter told them, we do not give you secular general education at JTS. You have to go to Columbia. You can only be accepted after you have a high school degree, and we can't help you. Of course, he called him Jacob Schiff, and Mr. Jacob Schiff began giving $1,000 a year to what today is YU, Harry Fischel, etc. A fascinating little story. But in 1906, the year before they went there, there was the first strike, the students not coming into the yeshiva, demanding general studies. They brought in Rabbi Leventhal, they brought in Rabbi Margolis, and while Rabbi Margolis' intentions were wonderful, and I described him last week, but nothing really changed. In 1908, a tremendous strike broke out. And this strike is the famous strike. And once again, it was a question of general studies. The students now, time is marching on, America is shifting gears. The children of the immigrants who came in the 70s, the 80s, are now going to college, college graduates. These young men are intelligent, and they need rabbanim who speak the language of the land. The board of directors responded with the old story, financial crisis. They threw out 15 students, and the 15 students who they threw out were exactly the 15 rabble raisers who were the heads of the striking students. So everyone saw through it. The Yiddish press, which had endless newspapers, endless dailies. Number one, you got to remember, everyone read Yiddish. Hundreds upon hundreds of thousands, if not 1 million, 1.5 million Jews, 2 million Jews read Yiddish. Number two, there was no radio, there was no TV, there was no internet. Today, newspapers are going out of business because everyone, myself included, gets the morning news from the internet, not from anywhere else. And I'm already a Johnny-come-lately. I only joined the club a few years ago. To my students in the Kollel said, Rebbe, it's a full Hashem, you don't know how to use a computer, turn on a computer. So they wore me down. And I said to one student whose picture I have with me today, show it to you later, I said to David, my mother learned how to use the computer, Zichrono Livracha, when she was over 70. Fine, I'm willing to try. And thank God the computer has saved, not only I've been able to save lives of difficult shilas through the computer, but that's a different story, how it can help you in paskining a halacha. Anyway, be it as it may, the newspapers were having a field day. The students called it a strike. The administrators said, these students of Chatzufim, we are locking them out. So it was a big machlekes, is it a strike or a lockout? But the newspapers took the side of the students. And here's an editorial or an op-ed piece that appears in one of the leading the Tageblatt, putting aside the Cincinnati Reform Factory. That's the way they referred to Hebrew Union College. There remains the competition between Schechter's rabbinical school and Reitz. Schechter's seminary, according to the intent of the founders and supporters of Reitz, is Jewish, but not religious. And what do they mean by that? That's what I explained to you. The learning level in Schechter's, who went there, someone after high school, someone in the middle of college, Columbia View, how much of a background did he have? They learned Masechet Megillah, all right, it took them a year. They learned Masechet Tain, it took them a year. The Balabatim on the east side of New York remembered that in Europe, they learned Masechet Megillah in a month's time. And this is why they could not accept the seminary graduates. We want, claimed the students, to know Talmud and codes better than the students of Schechter Seminary. We want to know all the material that the rabbis of Russia do, but we want to have as much secular education as the students of Schechter Seminary. We cannot be satisfied with the bit of English that the administration permits us to study. One second, Eli. Gentlemen, in this quote that I just gave you, you have a quagmire that lives on until this very moment in the year 2014. Have you studied Washington by my good friend? Yes or no? There's a passage in there that's overwhelming if you have a mind that cares about Torah and a heart that beats with a Torah beat. No, I want to ask you a question. Who knows more, a Lakewood graduate or a YU graduate? Who knows more? Who knows more? Who knows more Shas and Paiskim? Who knows more? Who knows more? I don't want to go any further. Who knows Kala Torah Kula? So it's very interesting. You see, Lakewood has turned out fellows who do know Kala Torah Kula. YU has turned out individuals who know Kala Torah Kula. Plus a little bit more. See, and this is the dilemma. How do you do it? How do you do it? And it's said so beautifully here. We want to know what the Russian rabbis knew. I'll talk about myself. I want to know as much and more than Rabbi Aaron Cutler knew, than Rabbi Moshe Feinstein knew, than Maria Rebbe Reb Soloveitchik knew. I want to. I don't say I'm a far way from it, but the will is there. See? So how do you balance out the two? It's a fabulous paragraph. So in Washington, I have an unbelievable story. It's a shame that people comment on the Russian episode, the Zionist episode. All right, I guess that's what attracts attention. But there are parts of Washington that you should think. You don't just read it. It's not a novel. When I lived in Lakewood, there was a fellow from Chicago. I can tell you his name, Berg. I don't know if he's alive anymore. Or maybe that's the name of the girl he married. I have to check with Malka. He married a friend of Malka. I greatly admired him. He was a B'nai Akiva kid who went into learning and never stopped learning. He was the biggest matmid in Lakewood. Rabbarin on Purim used to give a bottle of schnapps to the biggest matmid. This fella got it every year. And the only time he wasn't learning, he learned like from 7 in the morning till 2 at night, and Shabbos afternoon he went for a walk. The only time. And he used to invite a student to go for a walk with him. And occasionally he'd invite me, like it was the highest accolade you could extend to me, to walk with the biggest machmen. All right. At that point in life, he put in more hours of learning than I was to do in YU. Absolutely. But who learned more? When all was said and done, and that's the story I tell, how I'm standing on the subway, I'd come in by bus, whenever I could come in by bus, because when I came by car, you couldn't learn. So I preferred coming from Maplewood. It was a very long trip, like an hour and a half, an hour and 40 minutes, but I could learn, and I was young. I could carry sperm with me. Today, I can't even lift the sperm I carried then. So I remember standing on the subway waiting for the A train. I mean, if you're not a New Yorker, you can't appreciate it. But, and I'm learning. I was learning. I even tell you what I was learning. A Meiri, I'm Psachim. A Meiri, I'm Psachim. A Meiri that had just come out, what we spoke about yesterday, an edited edition. And this guy taps me on the shoulder. I take a look. There's the Machmet from Lakewood, holding the New York Times and holding the Wall Street Journal. He's a stockbroker. And he said he heard I have a shul, I'm building a shul, Maplewood, South Orange. Could he address the sisterhood? He'd like to speak about investment opportunities. And through the sisterhood, we, you know, invite the whole kahila. But the sisterhood was a live, functioning group, whereas we didn't have a brotherhood. A brotherhood was davening. You came to daven, you were part of the brotherhood. So I arranged it, absolutely. Now I want to ask you, who learned more over 50, 60 years? The YU guy who got himself advanced general degrees, secular degrees, I don't want to call it secular, general degrees, and or the Lakewood fellow who became a stockbroker. Do you know what it means to be a stockbroker? How many of you have been stockbrokers? You know what it was like in my shul the Shabbos after Kennedy was assassinated? I had two stockbrokers. One was a YU Musmach, actually, Jerry Kaysman, Zichrono Livracha. They came into shul pale. I don't know if they knew how to daven that Shabbos. You understand what I'm saying, Moshe? They were thinking, what's going to be after the funeral? What's going to be when everything, what was it, Tuesday? The funeral, I think, was Monday. You can correct me who remembers it. Sunday, there were 4 days of mourning. Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday. People were shaking. America's going to go under. The president assassinated. The Panovich Maskir, the Pchatsku Levenstein, Zeitz Tzadik Levracha, gave a shmuz in Panovich. Wer kann das glauben? Who can believe it? Es wird mir gesagt, als man in der Hage der Präsident von der United States war, kann gerufen am Schuggenab. Zet was wird von einem Mensch. I'm not translating. If you don't understand it, it's your loss. You don't know what went on. No, the stockbroker or the YU guy. Interesting question. You ever see Rabbi Lichtenstein's article in Geshe? Early 60s, I believe early 60s, could be it's even late 50s, but I believe early 60s, Rabbi Lichtenstein writes a fabulous article. And the whole article is summarized by this paragraph. And see, we who go to YU, we Taka want to do much more. I always said in Lakewood, I had time for everything. Time to daven, time to eat b'menuchah nefesh, time to learn musa, time to take a Gemara down and take a few minutes and open it properly. Why you? Every minute counted. Every second counted. You had to accomplish two different worlds in one day. But if you were studious, you got there. So this editorial from, mind you, 1908, we still deal with this until today. If you're a Ben Torah, if you're not a Ben Torah, then there's nothing to talk about. If you're just studying, like, I'm going to be a doctor, I'm going to be a rabbi, I'm going to be a lawyer. But if your whole being is consumed by Devar Hashem, no, we want to know Talmud and codes better than the student. Today, Shechter Seminary, nothing to talk about. I had a Talmud in the Kollel, Rabbi Leibayans, my Talmud. Fabulous guy. Leib was one of a kind. You know, he came from a Lakewood background. He knew Yiddish. He knew the only white sheep in a black family, using popular language, because his father is a giant, so I don't mean anything in a pejorative term. But so Leib was an amazing guy. He made friends with people, and one Friday night, he says, Rebbe, I'm going to the Kotel, and I said, you know, I'm going to be home Friday night. This Friday night we're dafka home. We were younger than today. We're really home. But I said, you know, come Friday night. He says, yeah, but can I bring this lady I met? She's studying to be a rabbi at Hebrew Union College. And he brings the lady. I couldn't believe. I said, do you study? And a nice girl. Don't misunderstand me. A nice woman. I shouldn't say girl, but, you know, in her 20s. She got married afterwards, a nice woman, a pleasant woman, a nice-looking woman. You know, fine, she'll be a rabbi, fine. So I said, well, what do you study? Well, we study some Talmud. What do you study in Talmud? They take an Agada, like you take, for the sake of argument, the Gemara and Churban Bayit, and they spend an entire year studying those four pages in Gittin, and analyze it, and talking about it, and sociologically, and historically, and economically, and philosophically. And this is called Talmud. It's unbelievable. We want to know. I want to be as big as their advisor. All right? But it's a modern world. It's a Western world. There's beauty out there. How do we balance it? Wow. What a paragraph. And here I'll give you, Ellie, you still have a question? Hold it off. I just want to give you one more treat. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. It's the cold. No wonder no one wants to come to the Griscoll over. Rav Aaron's not here. What are we coming for? All right. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. Press conference. Alon Shvut. Early 70s. What you fellas don't remember is Little Jerusalem. Little Jerusalem, I think even Yitzchak doesn't remember this. You know where the funerals were held? In Machne Yehuda. Sharei Tzedek was right next to Machne Yehuda, the Sharei Tzedek Hospital. It's now a landmark building, but I believe it's the Israeli Broadcasting Authority today. And right there was the Tahara Room. And right there, they wheeled out the body onto the street, a block away from the turmoil of Machne Yehuda. And we have a funeral. A young man died. His wife was the secretary of BMT. He was a principal of a teacher's college, a fine Talmud Chacham. His son, by the way, is a general in the Israeli Defense Forces today, or he may be retired already. He was a Hesder graduate, but didn't remain totally from, unfortunately, reached the rank of Major General. So at the funeral, you know, people are being maspid. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein is speaking. His son was a graduate or was a student in the Gush. And in the middle of the hesped, the Chevra Kadisha says, Lamata, Lamata, pushes us all down. There's another coffin being carried out, another bier, it's not a coffin, another stretcher being carried out. You follow me? So they make on this block the masbid, walk down here for block, finish the hesped, and drop the body into the ground. Okay. So a few weeks after this happened, there's a press conference at the Gush. And, you know, they're talking about this very issue. Israelis too are troubled by it. And one wise Alec kid, you know, again, students have to be wise Alecs. A Rebbe may be a Gon Shebegoinim, but in a kid's mind, this is a Rebbe, but he's also, you got to slap the Rebbe occasionally. So the kid's hand shoots up, and he says, Rav Lichtenstein, and the Yecholah, I can understand why we study mathematics. I can understand why we study physics. But English literature? And Rabari, without batting an eyelash, says to the kid, I don't know why we study English literature. Maybe it is important, maybe it isn't important. But one thing, you were at the funeral 2 weeks ago? Yes. You like what the Chevra Kadisha did? No. Disgrace, kid says. Rabari says, had they read Shakespeare and knew Hamlet, they wouldn't have acted that way. The place broke into pandemonium. Quote, end quote. That's what happened. That's this paragraph. 100%. Ellie, wag it out.
Just one clarification. Salish, nobody thought that JTS is from because of the low level of Gemara, or was it even an ideological?
No, I explained it last week. JTS was from at that time. That no one is debating. No one is debating. JTS was from. But who were they appealing to? The East European crowd. You understand? Forget about that. Bring me a yeshiva man. And you'll say to me, Rebbe, here he just got smicha, I don't know, Torah, Das Chaim in Berlin, whatever. Why you? I'll talk with him and learn him. Guy doesn't know. He's one level above Schottenstein. Follow? I'm not going to be impressed by this guy. So that was it. The people on the east side saying, given you the payisha.
But ideologically, it was still...
No, at that time, it was still from, of course. Absolutely. Kaplan at that point is a tzaddik yesod olam. No one will dream what will happen with Mordechai Kaplan. He's already assistant rabbi to Ramaz at Kilat Jeshurun. Kaplan, I told you, he became an oisfaf. You got to give him credit. They said, "Knew if you were such an up because why didn't you reveal it 10 years ago?" He said, "I waited until my parents died." You got to give him credit. At least he had keep it up a game. Show me kids today that have keep it up a game. 1 out of 100. Come on, let's be honest. I know what goes on in the world. Take my word for it. Okay. Now, this problem, the students now were empowered. They're no longer tens on strikes. There are hundreds. And what they do is they go to all the shuls on the Lower East Side. And you got to remember, what do people love about the internet? Gossip. Controversy. Machloket. The internet is a source of every drop of rechilit and lashon hara imaginable. There's a guy, Chaim Shulchan, has a blog on Charedim. The man wins the award for the most lashon hara rechilit that you can imagine, motzi shem ra, that can be published in one day. It is unbelievable. And he has, I'm not joking, I just looked at the blog for today. Your head falls off. And it's amazing how in every inger, in Panovich, wherever you will turn in the chief rabbinate, he has spies in who feed him information. You follow? Everything is a true, reliable, like it, fight, this, that. Oh my gosh. People thrive on it. Remember, how many people study Shmiret HaLashon and compare it with how many people study Mishnah Berurah? I'm willing to bet you it's 18 to 1 in favor of the Mishnah Berurah. So the Balabatim ate it up. Every shul, a rabbinical student from Reeds is speaking. And the battle is fought across the newspapers. The most famous Darshan at that period was Reb Tzvi Maslansky. It's a very famous name. He was, I would call him a precursor to what you call today the Mizrahi movement. He was a Talmud Chacham, he was a Rav, he was a Darshan par excellence. And he got up and spoke, and he riled up the masses. Now, by this point already, everyone and everybody reached total agreement. There must be general studies in Reeds. The boys are right. You cannot be a rabbi in America without knowing English, without knowing baseball. People recognized that the second generation, in other words, people like my parents, who spoke Yiddish, but it was no longer a native language. They went to school, they thought in English, they chanted in English, mit dem Mitzayelten und haben sie geredet Yiddish. Emes. True. But with their friends, with their peers, with their teachers, they spoke English, they were American kids. Many of us have the ability to speak more than one language, but there's only one language you count money in. That's when you see a person's real native language. And if you stand in one of the banks in Israel and watch people and hear the way they count, it's very fascinating how many different languages you will hear within a half hour. People who speak perfect Hebrew, and yet when it comes to counting, English, French, Russian, Amharic, Yiddish, go to Meir Shearim, you'll hear people speaking perfect Hebrew. When it comes to money, suddenly it's all in Yiddish. So everyone agreed, but now the machloket was, and again, I'm quoting from a Yiddish newspaper, that how much general knowledge do you need? Is it enough to have the equivalent of a gymnasium degree? Now remember, gymnasiums in Europe were more than high school. If you came to America with a gymnasium degree, they generally gave you credit for 1 year of college studies. Is that enough? A high school degree, gymnasium. I'm quoting, a knowledge of English. Do you have to know more? And certainly, Abal HaBas says, quote, a rabbi does not have to know Homer and Virgil. And how is it pronounced? Virgil? Maybe I pronounced it wrong. Anyway, you can correct me if you wish. It's a fabulous question. That question haunts us until today. Tell me, how many of you Chabadnikim? How many of you have gotten smicha from Chabad? How many Chabadnikim went to college? They're fabulous rabbis. They know English? Absolutely. Do they know every TV show? Absolutely. Do they know sports? Absolutely. Do they know Shakespeare by heart? Most of them, absolutely not. The Rav on the other hand, the Baron Lichtenstein on the other hand, or one Chabad rabbi who I met in Sydney, Australia, wow, what they could quote. Literature. The Rav knew all of Russian literature. The Baron, PhD, Harvard. English literature. Mathematics. Physics, chemistry, biology. Lubavitcher Rebbe. No? Is that Lachatchila or B'diyavad? What do they say in Lakewood? What do they say in Mir? What do they say in Panovich? Panovich today switched to English. You switched to Hebrew. You don't realize what a big step that was. Rav Shach switched to Hebrew. It was not easy for him. I told you more than once, I have a recording of Rav Shach, a video I videoed many years ago, where he speaks and all the eyes of the state of Israel are upon him, and the minute he gets emotional, he breaks into Yiddish. He cries in Yiddish, not in Hebrew. It's like Tova said about, once told me about her father, she summarized it. We were talking about how the Rav had such command of English, Yiddish, Hebrew, but Yiddish was Yiddish. Quote Tova, when the Rav spoke Yiddish, you cried with him. You laughed with him. Understand? Okay. How much does the Rav have to know? Lachatchila, what do you say? Go to high school. All right, get a high school degree. Genug. You speak English. You know how to turn a radio on, how to turn a TV on, how to turn a computer on today. It's genug. Mindaf nicht mehr. We don't need more than that. Or no. And see, this became part of the big machloiket. Because the Balabatim already of Reeds, the Yisachars, were willing. Have a high school, have good English classes. You don't need more than that. It doesn't have to be formal training. The state doesn't require high school. Remember, we're talking 100 plus years ago. It's not like today that technically a kid has to be in school, I think, until he's 18. He has to have, or a high school degree. And by the way, they're cracking down in New York. A whole new era is developing because they did investigation. If you're following what's happening, that many of the so-called yeshiva high schools, the Hasidic ones, etc., it's a big farce when it comes to the general subjects that are taught. So it seems now with the Weberman debacle, with the tragedy here that happened with this maneuver, and with the Mitzitza Bepen, it turns out now a third child was infected by herpes, and people are taking on the power of Satma, and unfortunately we dance with Satma. It's not just Lakewood dances with Satma. Who would believe that Rav Aaron's grandson would stand together with a Satma Rebbe at the Asifa? You have no idea how offensive that was to the old-time Lakewood people. Rav Aaron was furious at the Satma Rebbe. You know how many votes the Satmar Rebbe has caused, how many seats in the Knesset the Satmar Rebbe has caused, Agudat Yisrael? You know how much money was lost to Torah that went to General Kibbutzim and went to Mapam and Shmutz and elsewhere because of the Satmar Rebbe? And today, the OU is shaking. No, why is the OU shaking? Gentlemen, you know or you don't know? Because of the Satmar. Do we stand shoulder to shoulder with them? Fear with Kashrut, Weatherman, the statement, the retraction, you're up to date or you're not up to date. The OU is shaking, not the Kashrut division. Kashrut division is separate. I tell everyone it's not affected by what's going on in the upper floor of the OU. Satma, once again, it's a whole fascinating question. What's sufficient? What do we need more? Not fake eye, not just a broken English, not just a daily news English, but the English of the New York Times. And it's either my vote or the Rav's vote. I've said it over, so it may be my vote, but I may have heard it from the Rav. The vote, quote, end quote. But I'll credit myself simply because I'm not certain I heard it from the Rav. We all assimilate. We all live in two societies. We all are affected by what goes on beyond us. There's no way to escape today. But the difference is whether you come into the general society on the level of the Daily Znut or on the level of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. That's the difference. And that's the machlokes right here. It's just amazing that in 1908, the exact problems that haunt us until today were on the agenda. Rav Tzvi Hirsch Maslansky, and by the way, I've taught direct descendants of his, got up and called upon the worshippers, the Balei Batim, the Daveners, wherever he spoke, and he was a fabulous speaker, called upon them, support the students. And they used an example for what the students want, Yeshiva Torah Vadat. Let me say it properly. Torah Vedat. In our Yiddish, Teda Vedas of Lida. You know what I'm talking about? That was really the first real yeshiva high school on a level in modern times. Organized by Rabbi Yaakov Reines, the founder of the Mizrahi movement, a Volozhiner graduate, Rav Yaakov Yitzchak Reines, he organized Torah Vedas. What was the concept? It was Torah Vedat and general knowledge. Who was the Rosh Yeshiva there? No, Rav Shlomo Palachik, the Mechita Eloi. That's the first institution that he was associated with. That's the famous story when he starts to become a Mizrachiite and he's... And he has this chance to become a member of the faculty. There's going to be a Beis Medrash. And he asks Reb Chaim for a letter or a smicha or what. We don't know, you know, it's anecdotal. And Reb Chaim turns away and cries. And until today, there are two versions. One version is that the Mechita says to his Rebbe, well, if you're not happy with what I'm doing, I don't need a letter from you. The other version is that the Reb Chaim gave him a letter, but cried as he was writing it that the student was going on a different path. That was the Mechita. He plays a very big role in our lives, and we will come back to him many times over. But here, they hold up Yeshiva Torah Vedas in Lida. This is before World War I. This yeshiva is in its prime. It's wiped out by World War I. This is what we need in the United States. And for the sake of historical accuracy, believe it or not, Charlie, Misifta Teira Vadas, that began in Williamsburg, was organized to be like Teira Vedas in Lida, Mizrahi people. That is an absolute fact. Today you walk into Teira Vedas. Where is it today? In Flatbush? I don't know where it is. Someplace, I know where Chaim Berlin is. It's in Kensington, so it's further over. They tell me if you walk in, you think you're in a Hasidic shtibble. Every last student in my days, Teira Vedas, was not much different than Yeshivas Reb Yitzchok Chanan. And today, Hasidim have conquered the world, and among their conquests, Teira Vedas, and very shortly it will be announced that Yeshivas Reb Yitzchok Chanan, Yeshiva University, has been conquered by the Hasidic world. They're going to announce it very shortly. This week it may even be the announcement. My Talmud, Rabbi David Weinberger, the Eish Kodesh Rebbe, is becoming the Moshe Weinberg. I said David because you know who David is. David is his neighbor. They're going crazy in the five towns, I'm told, because the five towns went right. So all the Rabbanim would say, what do you mean we went right? The most right among us is a YU graduate, is a Talmud of Rakefet. Moshe Weinberger, Eish Kodesh, Areba. And now the most right-wing guy and all the Rabbanim like Rabbi David Weinberger who are able to malamit skut, we're right-wing. We're nothing compared to Rabbi. He now is becoming Mashkiach Ruchani of Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchok Elchanan. Hasidim have won out. And I mode HaKadosh Baruch Hu that my Talmidim enlightenment enabled me to teach and let me continue even though I am a relic and I understand under my picture they don't use my name, they simply say a dinosaur. Ellie, without a sense of humor and humility, you cannot survive. You have a sense of humor. What about humility? Have you studied Musa? What do you mean? You got a long way to go. We'll talk about it at the press conference. Not Sam, not just Ellie. Musa, the generation, what's going on? Anyway, the machloket here is unbelievable because these are the very problems that we face in Pool today, 2014. And these problems are as real today as they were then. No? You go, you have a shayla, you're in college, you're learning around the clock, but you need a panasa, you want to study, you're interested in Chinese literature. You were told that China will conquer, by the way, very true, they plead with people to learn Chinese here, Hebrew, they plead with people, because China will conquer the world, they're the biggest economic power in the world, but they just warned Obama, stop printing money, you understand, they can talk that way, because America is bankrupt, okay. So you go to some of your Rebbeim and YU, I don't want to mention names. You say, Rebbe, I have a chance to major in the Jewish subjects in college. You know, it's an easy major, education, an easy major. Or I can study Chinese literature and they give me permission to go to Columbia U, certain classes they have there that YU doesn't have an arrangement, whatever. I'm talking in theory. I don't know what the facts are on the ground. So what will the Rebbe say to you? Study Chinese literature, the Rav would say, and let me know in their literature if you find any similarities to concepts in Chazal or in the early Jewish philosophers. A Rebbe today, Chas v'chalila, Chinese literature will take you so much time, you won't be learning, you won't have time for learning, remain in Jewish subjects, it's an easier major. Follow? The problem exists until today. Now, turn the problem around. 30 years later, the guy who studied Chinese literature as a world famous professor, he teaches 4 hours a week, he learns Shas and Paiskim 4 hours a day. The guy who went into Judaic subjects all his life, he's not a good teacher, he doesn't have that ability to teach, he couldn't hold the position, he went into the rabbinate, he had to deal with balabatim, he has ulcers, no one will sell him life insurance, he can barely open a gemara, b'menucha tanefesh. You see, it's not so simple. But the problems are with us until today. Now, watch what happens. This is amazing. And this is on page 106 of Gil Clapman's published doctorate, because I worked, before it was published, I worked from his manuscript. In my doctorate, you'll see I cite Gil, but I cite him from his doctoral manuscript. And it's published, you have to cite from the published form. Page 106, very interesting. Watch. Imagine you're going with a girl, and this happens. And most parents of a girl is young, girl is beautiful, girl is capable, and most men at 23, 24 are jerks. That's the nature of the beast. So the parents aren't happy with you. You know, they have a princess. So, you take the girl out, Then one day the girl tells you, you're invited to our home, my parents want to meet you. Oh my gosh. Then you know the terrain has shifted. You follow me? Ah, you come in, back Lawrence. No, it's before they were washed away by Sandy. But back Lawrence, you know, I always say you come into Homestead, you need a map. They have to give you a map to find your way around the house, the bedroom you'll be sleeping in. This is the dining area. This is where the svarim are. This is the study. When we were in Chicago just now, the apartment place at our disposal, a finished basement, was twice as big as my whole apartment in the state of Israel. And you know what the joker is? That beautiful house in Chicago probably is worth $300,000. I may be overstating the case. My closet in Yerushalayim, I can't even mention to you. Let's suffice it to say that the apartment next door just changed hands for 3 million shekel. And it was overbid. You know the story. They went on the market at 2.9. Immediately, someone bid, this was in 4 days it was sold, someone bid 2.8, someone who knows me from Woodmere, and this other person who knows me, who lives here, saw what's happening, he bid 3. No, the people wanted to sell, they were told 2.9 is a good price, they hear 3, they sold within 4 days. Agents complained to me that they never got a chance to do anything. You follow me, Yaakov, that before they knew it, the apartment was gone. All right. My dear students, you're invited back, Lawrence. Parents want to meet you. You come in. Beautiful silverware. Oh, beautiful china. You've made it. That's exactly what happened. On May 12th, 1908. What happened was, the students were boiling mad. The masses were rabble-roused. The speakers were letting the balabatim have it. They called a meeting for 4 o'clock at the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society Hall on East Broadway. The meeting begins, and people are yelling and shouting, and an hour goes by, and what are we going to do? And this is on the east side. And in the middle of the meeting, a messenger comes in, Nathan Lamport has sent him. He wants you to adjourn the meeting, and 7 o'clock, there will be another meeting at Kehillat Jeshurun on the Upper East Side. Pandemonium broke out. Joy, tears. Back Lawrence, the doors are open. Rodeo Drive, welcome. Everyone went uptown. You don't know what this meant. Ah, at this meeting, you had the students, you had Maslansky, you had the leading Rabbanim, a good Rabbanim now is a powerful organization. There is a whole new atmosphere, and there is absolute unanimity that REITs must be reorganized. Proper general studies and a definitive program that will fit in with the dreams, visions, and quests of the East European Jew on the American scene. It was sheer joy. The Balabatim capitulated. The narrow-minded ones were voted down. The multi-millionaires who had made it were much more open-minded. KJ was not the Lower East Side. And that night, the seeds are planted for what today is Yeshiva University. Now, how do you do it? And here's where we left off last week. I'm filling in a lot of details which I didn't do last week, but how do you do it? Ramaz was a tremendous Talmud Chacham, a tzaddik, a chassid. There are miracle stories told about him. Wie man sagt in Yiddish, et geweisen, et gewissen meufsen. He did miracles attributed to him. People loved him, people stood in awe of him. People had tremendous derech eretz. Americanized, yes, but to a limited degree. On the other hand, you had in Philadelphia the man who was called by his contemporaries the most Americanized Rav of the Agudas HaRabbanim. And that, of course, was Reb Dov Aryeh HaKohen Leventhal. And I explained to you last week, he had smicha from Yitzchok Hanan, was a Talmud Chacham, had a tremendous head. Rabbanim once said about Rabbi Leventhal, he must have a fabulous memory, because from the day he arrived in America, he hasn't had time to open a Gemara. And you can take it out allegorically or factually, but there's a lot to it. No one would talk about Rabbi Leventhal as gewissen Meufsen, that he could do miracles. This wasn't a Hasidic rabbi, a Hasidic type. He was totally with it. He knew what America was all about. Totally integrated. And Ramaz, Rabbi Margolis, there was another famous rabbi, Rabbi Shimon Zivitz from Pittsburgh, who starts to play a big role on the American rabbinical scene. Everyone turns to Rabbi Leventhal. And they say, we have to follow the example of JTS. What put JTS on the map? Bringing Solomon Schechter to Broadway and 122nd Street. We want you to come to New York and take over Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. You will be the president, the Rosh Yeshiva, the Balabatim will give you the money, and what all any decision that you make, we will accept Ketorah Misinai. It was a fabulous solution. And Rabbi Leventhal, you know, at a certain point in life, you're willing to shift gears. It's early in the year, it's May. He makes a condition, he'll be willing to take the position, but he must remain in Philadelphia until after the High Holy Days. And then he will move to New York, he will leave Philadelphia, and belay the nefesh, he will take over Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. Balabatim in Philadelphia went crazy. Don't leave us. You are our sustenance. You are our Rebbe. You are our heart. Demonstrations, shuls, he had total loyalty. He ruled Philadelphia like a monarch. Like a monarch. It's the elite. You can tell you're not directly descendant, but tell those who are directly descendant that he was a monarch. You can quote me. Well, he couldn't leave entirely. And let me take you into modern times. And let me give you a little bit background. Living history. Rabbi Lamb steps down. The leading candidate who would have had the job, it would have been practically unanimous, was a classmate of mine. His name, Rabbi Steve Riskin, Shlomo Riskin, would have been unanimous. All right, the Rosh Yeshiva were yelling, they had problems with... No, it would have been unanimous, with very heavy money behind him. Rabbi Riskin, what he has done, what he has created, please, don't minimize it. Don't give all the credit to London, Rabbi Robinson. There was a tashtit before. Riskin, Rabbi Riskin, Shlomo, Steve, turn the tide. What a story. He would have had it. But he had one problem. He built the kehillah in Efrat. Built it from the ground. When you say the word Efrat and you ask any intelligent person, who do you identify with Efrat? They're going to answer you, Harav Shlomo Riskin. There's children here. The grandchildren here. Above all, he has his wife. We can't leave. Can't give it all up. Well, Rabbi Riskin was willing to make a compromise. The flying rabbi, you're young, you have energy. Thursday through Sunday he's here. Monday through Wednesday he's in New York. YU, world institution. Rabbi, how can you do this? We need a full-time head. I work around the clock. I accomplish twice as much as anyone else. And there is truth to it. That is Rabbi Riskin's secret of success. He only needs, at the most, 4 hours of sleep a night in his prime. They can tell you stories about Rabbi Riskin that were absolutely to be true. He'd be working, speaking, doing affairs, weddings, bar mitzvahs, go to bed 1 o'clock, wake up at 4:30, give a daf yomi at 5, as if he slept 8 hours. That's a certain koach. The Vilna Gaon had that koach. Spoke about it years ago. Read the Haktamah of Bnei HaVilna Gaon to his Ha'arot, his Haga'ot, on Shulchan Aruch Aruch Chaim. But the Balabatim, you know, these Balabatim at NYU, again, I tell you about, I said in class years ago, I say it again. Remember I went crazy quoting the Gemara, Rebbe Hayam Chabed Ashirim. This is a message for us? A rabbi has to respect money? If I respected money, I wouldn't be sitting here today. Rebbe, this is a message? This is Chazal? Chazal knew exactly what they were talking about. When you have a Balabas who made billions of dollars on his own, like Bennett or Barkat, you better respect these people. There's a lot you can learn from them. Balabatim, a Balabatim. And one of the key Balabatim got up at a board of directors meeting at YU and said, we do not want a part-time president. YU is too big, too important, too demanding, too many decisions to be made. And with all due respect to Rabbi Riskin, he will only be a part-time president. And the tide turned, the rest is history. For the first time in the history of YU, you have a balabas, an administrator, who runs Yeshiva University and does a darn good job, Richard Joel. But what I told you, now go back to Rabbi Leventhal. He wanted to be like Rabbi Riskin. Commute. Work out a compromise. Became president, became Rosh Yeshiva, commuted, but it couldn't be total success. You can't run an institution that needs a head 24/7, part-time in Philadelphia, part-time in New York. That problem continues until today, even with our instant communication. How many of you are members of RCA? How many of you members of the OU? RCA had a president a few years ago who lived in Seattle, Washington. Tell me, where's the main office of RCA? In the heart of Manhattan. The OU. Can you have a president of the OU living in Cincinnati, Ohio, or living in St. Louis, Missouri, when the main office is at Battery Park, 11 Broadway? The only office, the main office. I'm not talking about a political office in Washington. It's a tremendous problem. But the die was cast. No more strikes. No more animosity. Planning ahead. Moving ahead. More classes. More general studies. A much more benevolent attitude towards the students. The Balabatam who now are running the show, many of them quite wealthy, and many of them upset that their English is accented. Many of them making the effort themselves to have private lessons in English so they can deal with Reform Jewish magnates and non-Jewish magnates and speak a good, non-accented American English. Not only that, the Balabatam mention a name, David Cohen. He dies before his dream comes to fruition. Harry Fischel, a name you all know. Abe Rothstein, the son of Josh Rothstein, the father of Arnold Rothstein. These are the same Balabatam who get hit up for every charity on the East Side. And when it comes to Chinuch, you have three institutions to support. RJJ, Eitz Chaim, and Reitz. And they start dreaming. We got to build a big institution. We got to build a proper campus. We have to have a real structured general studies program and rabbinical program for that matter. Let us merge. And talks begin by 1910, 1911. These are the main topics. 1912. Now, mergers are not easy. Because we're human beings. And human beings have vested interests. I can give you many examples from contemporary society, but you can take two shuls that are struggling. Logically, become one. Right away, there's a problem of nusach. One shul is nusach sfad and one shul is nusach hashkenaz. Right away, there's a problem of two rabbis. Panasa. I don't want to minimize the problems. I want you to understand them. Right away, there's a problem of covered. Human beings, I don't understand it, but I'm a very poor example because if you're not a covered seeker, you don't achieve anything in life, perhaps. You follow me, Daniel? I just think what I just said. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. But there's something to it. Problem of covered. You can't have two presidents. You can't have two vice presidents. And mergers are hard to come by. Sometimes mergers should have happened ages ago, but they don't happen until the last moment when they're at the ibis of despair. So it doesn't happen overnight. But what seemed to be shaping up was RJJ would not merge, would not be merged, because RJJ had a specific goal which couldn't be bridged with advanced education. RJJ by this time was a full A grade elementary yeshiva. The mother of all American day schools. They deserve that title. So IJJ remains Rabbi Yaakov Yosef. Remember I told you originally it was called Teferet Yerushalayim. It changed the name to honor the late chief rabbi. But by the way, someone, one of the emails I got, let me answer it. I don't know, I got so many emails that some I just got lost in the shuffle. I don't know if I answered this. But someone said to me that, what's his name? Sana, Professor Sana, spoke about RJJ recently. And he wonders if Professor Sana doesn't listen to my Shayurim. So I just want to say, I'm not the only one who knows about RJJ. You know, I don't think there are people who listen to my Shayurim. I can tell you, I've seen Gedolei Yisrael, and suddenly I see Chidushim I say here on a Sunday, suddenly appear. It's either Shnei Neviyim Mitnavnim B'Signon Echad, or one is copying off the other, and reach your own conclusion. But RJJ, I don't have a monopoly on the knowledge of RJJ, so, I mean, Professor Sana couldn't know about RJJ totally on his own. Anyway, anyone know Professor Sana? He lives in Teaneck, New Jersey, if I'm not mistaken. He's very, very big in the field of Jewish sociology, I would say. Anyway, coming back here, RJJ remains on its own. But what do we do with Eitz Chaim and Ritz? And here there's overlapping. Because Eitz Chaim has the general studies, although it's in a, I would say, use the word, the zealotry form yet. It's not concrete. It's not compartmentalized yet. Reads is like a base medrash. On the other hand, there are fellows learning in Eitz Chaim who, on a Torah level, really are in Ritz. And Eitz Chaim, they're only taking advantage of the high school or the general studies. So the idea develops to merge Eitz Chaim with Ritz. Ritz will be the name that wins out because once again, Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzhak Elchanan speaks to the East European crowd. Everyone reveres the memory of the chief rabbi of Kufna. And as part of Ritz, we have to have a high school. And that high school will take over in a very organized form and authorized by the state. And under supervision of the New York Board of Regents, that high school will take over the general studies that were taking place under the aegis of Eitz Chaim. That's the dream. Then you need a building. You can't go on a little building on Henry Street. And they start looking around, and on Montgomery Street, they find two buildings next to each other, 9 and 11. And they now have Harry Fischel, builder, par excellence. He takes over, knocking out the buildings, rebuilding them, connecting them. And that will be the first home, 9-11 Montgomery Street, of the merged institutions, Eitz Chaim and Yeshivat Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan. This is the dream. This is the vision. This is the quest, but there's one ingredient we need. Where's the Rabbi Riskin? Where's the Rabbi Leventhal? Where's the Rabbi Margolis? Where do we find someone who has the learning, the knowledge, the respect the general knowledge appreciation, who can devote himself full time to build Torah in America. And here was the miracle. And of course, Rabbi Dr. Bernard Revel. Yad Hashem, the first man to successfully turn the spades of Torah on American soil. What that man did, what that man created, beyond words. But before we come to him, they negotiate with Rabbi Revel. It's not easy for him to make the decision to leave the world of commerce. But the call of Torah is just overwhelming. And Hanukkah 1915, they have the Chanukah Tabayit and the official introduction, inauguration of Rabbi Revel as president of the faculty and Rosh Yeshiva. One full week of celebration. Why Hanukkah? Obvious. What does Hanukkah represent? Chinuch HaMizbeach, the rededication of the temple by its sheni. And here on Montgomery Street, a group of East Side Jews, 1 week long of celebration, every night Rabbanim and prominent Balabatim spoke, everyone dreamt and declared that this yeshiva will be like the Beit HaMikdash of old and consecrate American Jewry to Torah. The New York Tribune sent their reporters, evaluated the event. I quote, young men with long forelocks and drooping shoulders mounted with quick springy steps the stairs of 11th Montgomery Street yesterday. The forelocks, probably I understand, means the payas. These are kids who came over from Europe. I imagine they had real payas. Where we have payas, but I wouldn't call these forelocks. The forelocks were prescribed by Orthodox Jewish law, and the droop of the shoulders was due to a life occupied mainly with poring over their ancient tomes and yellowed print. They should have been sitting along narrow benches with skullcaps perched on their heads and rocking to and fro as they intoned in sing-song fashion passages from the Talmud. But these students, who had come from Russia, Galicia, and Romania, were to be introduced to the Occident and its ways. You all know what the word Occident means, right? I explained it. Like the West. Culture. Sophisticated culture. New York has seen the last of the ancient Cheder, where Jewish youth studied the Talmud through the watches of the night. Old country methods of education. This has all been abolished yesterday. Therefore, the East Side, which in many ways is trying to forget what it suffered abroad, celebrated. And you understand what they're saying. This is a very pro-editorial, but it's an American context. Europe is behind us. The Cheder is behind us. The old-fashioned way we studied, no more. It is going to be an American yeshiva. The Reform Movement, very caustic, very anti. The American Israelite, their official publication, did not hesitate, and I quote, to pronounce the New York Yeshiva an anachronism for which the United States has neither the time nor the place, and every dollar spent for its maintenance is that much wasted or worse. A legitimate use can be found for every dollar that the Jews of the United States can spare, and there is none to waste for transplanting into an American soil an institution of the medieval ghetto. Quote, end quote. You see? That's the way Reform viewed us. That's the way the New York Times viewed us. That's the way Roosevelt's aides viewed us. Have you studied the Silver Era? A quote.
How can we study it?
I hope, Rabbi Rubin is complaining it's out of print. I hope someone is listening in America and coming up with the money. What's happening? The OU is in turmoil. There's no one to turn to. I'm waiting to hear from America. But believe me, it's upsetting to me that two volumes like that, that are so needed, we have to worry about money. It's simply not fair. I have to worry about, I'm working on now, the American Orthodox Rabbinate. I mean, classes like this would have never been given, but I have to have material on a level. I'm working, boy, you got to see what I... Okay, but that's next year, the year afterwards. God should spare us. But what did they call Orthodoxy to President Roosevelt? A sickly leaf transplanted from Europe. Quote, end quote.
Who said that?
Who said that? Open up the Silver, you'll see. That's the advisors, to the advisors, the Jewish advisors. I give you the names there. I give you the source. I'm not making it up. No, I don't know if he said it, but the people in government, when Roosevelt, with the demonstrations, with the 1943 march, and what? What is Obama told by his Jewish advisors? We have to go back to 1943. Let's talk about 2013. What is Obama told? Guys like Rakefet, fanatics, chauvinists, fascists. No one ever quotes the Bible. God gave us this land. No one ever quotes it. Not the people around Obama. Understand? He's not anti-Semitic. Chas v'chalila. But the Jews that he knows, this is the level in which they think. Bush could never understand, the son, Bush, could never understand Reform Judaism. Because he knew Torah Jews. It's a big difference. A big difference. But what an editorial. Wow. You see what they were up against? JTS was quiet on this. Because JTS... You see, it was to their advantage, basically, that there should be a Reitz. Ultimately, when you look at the history of JTS until the 1980s, let's say, the majority of their students were Reitz graduates. It's an amazing... Think of the 40s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s. Even in the 60s, I had Talmidim in the Kollel, whose fathers were younger than I am. Labriyot graduated Yeshiva College, went to JTS. That was the future. All right, a little compromise. We'll make a little compromise. We'll get Jews to identify as Jews. All right, it was a tragic mistake. Now they admit it. Those that are really concerned with Judaism, what has happened, admit that when they permitted the driving to shul on Shabbos, they planted the seeds for the disillusion and the total non-commitment that you have in conservative Judaism today. But who would guess at that time? And who wrote the tshuva? Rabbi Friedman was a Reitz graduate. Jacob Agus, right or wrong, a Reitz graduate. Rabbi Adler of Detroit, his father was Mashgiach for Reb Moshe Feinstein in MTJ. Who wrote that tshuva? So you see, JTS, they were silent in all this. They understood, look, we don't yet fill the bill. You should know Solomon Schechter was opposed to speaking Yiddish. You're aware of it. He felt that in America, we have to speak a proper English. He was a British gentleman. He had taught at Cambridge. What's this? We're going to speak Yiddish in America? Absolutely not. So you understand, if the seminary already has a fear or an antipathy, would be a better word, for speaking Yiddish, they understood, all right, let there be a Reitz. And yet then all these students were bilingual. It's not like our time that you sit in the Reitz class and you throw out a word in Yiddish, no one knows what you're talking about. Take the most prominent rabbis that YU produced, Rabbi Heschel Schachter, the senior. His native language was Yiddish. He was Rabbi David Hollander. No, did you ever hear Rabbi Hollander speak? There was no orator who could equal David Hollander. But he spoke equally well in Yiddish or English. The Rav, our Rebbe, no? Who gave YU its identity? Yiddish, English, right down the line. Anyone, all the famous Rabbanim of that era, one after another, Rabbi Gilbert Klapperman, Rabbi Samuel Edelman of Denver, Zeichet Tzadik Livracha. What language they spoke? Yiddish as well. So JTS did not complain about the money, the competition. They were silent. But they were sort of adopting an attitude, let's wait and see. No one could believe this would get off the floor. The meantime, the masses on the east side were very proud, because look what they created on their own. And let me end off the class. The American Jewish Chronicle, which was a new publication, pro-Torah, in English, quote, without any help from the higher-ups, the large Jewish masses of the country have built up an institution which is to give life and content to American Judaism in the future, quote unquote. And you see the pride here? Who helped them? Not Temple Emanuel, not Jacob Schiff, $1,000 a year when you think of what Fishel and Lamport are going to give to the yeshiva. It's nothing. Gottesman, what's $1,000 compared to $100,000? No one helped them. Hebrew Union College, the Reform movement, poked fun at them, tried to stop them in any way possible. JTS had a quixotic attitude. We're struggling, and these greenhorns are going to succeed. And the masses from within, the David Cones, the Harry Fishels, the Rothstein family, the Balabatim who lifted themselves by their 10 fingers, lifted themselves above the crowd. Look what they did. We merged. We're going to have a high school. You don't know what a high school meant. Today, big deal, you have a high school. Who doesn't have a high school? Those days, a yeshiva high school? Unheard of. Two buildings knocked together. A large building that can hold hundreds of students. It'll become overly crowded very rapidly. It's not the final home of the yeshiva before it moves uptown. But they have achieved. They are proud. Now, want to add one other thought that's, again, one of these if questions. So fascinating. Reitz had bought some property in Harlem. When I say the word Harlem, I'm talking about Harlem where my parents were born. Harlem was 1912, like talking about buying property in Scottsdale today. That was the next area of settlement. Harlem, the Jews overran Harlem. By World War I, early 20s, Harlem had the biggest shuls. They bought property. Part of the merger, there was a very serious debate. Where do we open the newly formed yeshiva? Harlem would be fabulous. It's to tomorrow. But remember, you have a high school. The concept of a dormitory didn't exist yet. Most of the future students were on the Lower East Side. Part of the merger, that have money to buy Montgomery Street, they sold off the property in Harlem. Now that, when you look at it from the vantage point of history, imagine had the yeshiva opened in Harlem. Could be, we'd still be in Harlem today, just like the Jewish Theological Seminary. You follow? There at 122nd and Broadway, I don't know the exact address of the property in Harlem, maybe it's in a footnote in Gill's work, but we might have never moved uptown. Perhaps Harlem would have remained a major Jewish neighborhood. Today, believe it or not, if you know what's going on in New York, and Moshe, how do you know? You're from Atlanta. But Jews are moving uptown, uptown, uptown. You're coming pasha to 100th Street, and you see Jews, 110th, you have synagogues. Who knows, had yeshiva not given up that property. So my dear students, what did we do today? Let me reiterate, we have obviously set the stage for a very important lecture next week, Be'ezrat Hashem, on who was Aaron Rakefet's cousin, Rabbi Dov Revel. Wow. Yitzchak, you don't believe he was my cousin?
No.
I'm going to give you the sources next week.
We needed to get some more material on the...
I'm going to give you the sources. Bernard Leventhal, you have his family here. What do you want out of me? But Bernard Leventhal, no, you want... I know what you want on Bernard Leventhal. We might get to it when we deal with the American rabbinate.
And Google is very weak.
No, no. No, so I want to tell you, with Rabbi Bernard, I know what you want. You want what went on with Philadelphia later. That's a different story. But I'll tell you what should be done. A doctorate should be done on Bernard Leventhal. And this is the tragedy of Bernard Rebel. When it comes to doctorates in this area, no one is doing anything.
The tragedy is that the American Jewish History Department at YU is, I don't know what it is.
Okay, I don't know. I'm not...
All these men that you were mentioned in the lectures, you would think that there would be such a course. NYU. It's just natural.
No, but not too many people know this material. Or to put it a little differently, I think it's limited to the four walls of Chris Colwell. And this is why I want to get it out of my system.
This is not esoteric stuff.
No, but you have to spend... it's not esoteric, but you have to spend a lifetime researching it. I've lived it. I've researched it. Whatever the reasons are, you gotta know. It's not so simple. With Rabbi Dov, I'll tell you who might have material that no one else has. Rabbi Heschel Shechter of the Rosh Yeshiva. His father, Rabbi Melech, was Rabbi Leventhal's heir at a certain point. And Rabbi Leventhal was very close to Rabbi Shechter. And Rabbi Shechter left Philadelphia not because he was unhappy, but because he wanted Heshi to have a good education, a Torah education, which you couldn't get in Philadelphia at that time. There was no real elementary yeshiva on a level. It's not today. So Reb Heschel may know things that none of us know, but you got to get him, bring him into the kollel. I'll be happy. I'll sit with him and we'll question him and bother him. And then you got to know, if people are willing to talk. Zelo pashut. Some people say, no, it's not important. But he was a very, very fascinating individual. The critique against him, what you're alluding to, I think, is that later, when YU would reach, started producing Rabbanim in America, the Agudat HaRabbanim rabbis felt threatened. And we're going to talk about that next year, Be'ezrat Hashem. That's what I've worked on. I've worked that out. A lot of material on that. It was not so much finding material, but rather to not to say everything, or it would be endless, and give you sources. But that's an interesting question, and that's again part of life. Adam Karay Veitzel Atzmo. If someone comes into you and says, "I'm better than you. I know more than you. Step aside. Let me take over." Would you do it? I don't know. That's an interesting question. This is why Rabbi Yehuda Amital is an unbelievable example of an individual who stepped aside and brought in Rabbanu Lichtenstein. And so many years, they never had a machloket with two totally different outlooks at times, but they understood Torah is more important than any particular outlook. Kol hakavod to them, kol hakavod. Okay, so let me reiterate. I have a few things I want to show you. What do we do today? 1906 and above all, 1908. And the top moment is when the meeting on the east side in Hayas is interrupted and they're called to come uptown. They give them 2 hours to travel. I don't know how they traveled at that point, if they were horse and buggies, if they walked, I don't know. I have no idea how they went uptown. And the meeting continues at KJ. And that was the turning point. And it took a while, but there was, the remaining years, there was no tension. Because in principle, everyone agreed already. They elaborated and extended the secondary courses at Fritz, at Eitz Chaim, I should say, so that the students did have an outlet, but the need for an organized high school, that was very great. And a proper building and what to do with RJJ, and this was the merger, not a triple merger, but a double merger. And RJJ remains independent. And all this would have come to naught except for finding the proper man, Rabbi Dr. Dov Revel. Okay, next week I have to tell you very important shayurim for Monday, you know what it is, and Sunday, Be'ezrat HaNotein Le'Yof Koach, I'm going to show you the other point of view, give you some very fascinating sources, and I'm going to deal with an issue. Professor Samuel Atlas, that again has to torture us at this very moment in time. How do we handle it? Very fascinating. Now, I just want to say, this is the book that has taken away, I'm afraid, my Olam Haba, and I don't like it. But I highly, highly recommend it. This book reveals what the branch of the Mossad that I worked for did in Russia. What's amazing about the book, you'll never know the Mossad is involved unless you recognize the name Shaul Avigur. But I can't get over that. I write, never make it clear, never tell you where the millions and billions of dollars came from. There's no author to the book, but that's it's a sad story. It's simply the man who did the research, and he interviewed me years ago, Razna. I know his feeling at the end, at Shlomo Razna. At the end, he had 500 pages, and they cut it down to 240 pages. So he was angry, and he wouldn't let them use his name. What's fascinating about the book is that it's honest. He went through the papers at the Mossad, the reports. It's totally honest. There's no bias whatsoever. I have to say, kol hakavod. For myself and my wife personally, it's very frightening that we're getting credit. This is not Rakefic writing Washington, which can be filled with lies and fairy tales, right or wrong. Who that knows what he's writing? And this is a third party writing. It's overwhelming.
So you list names of people who went?
You'll see. Because the author was angry, he didn't write an introduction. So I can't, the only names that I understand, I spoke as well with Shaya Gafni, we both have the same conclusion. Anyone who went from Israel is listed full name. Anyone who went from England, America, etc., it's a first name with a last initial. So at times it's very funny because he writes about Yitzchak and Blue Gimel. Now you tell me who Yitzchak and Blue Gimel are. You understand? There's only one blue in the world. Also, I am a published photographer. I get credit, and I checked it out. No less than 10 pictures of mine appear in this volume with credit. I have pictures published in textbooks, and it's SSSJ because no one was allowed to know when Israeli was in Russia. So I am very proud, but a little bit worried that Tzaddik shouldn't get rewarded in this world.
Where is it available?
It's Mekash Shazah, so it should be all over. I mean, it's a. I don't know if it's out yet. I think March 4th is the date of publication. One second. Sam, do you have the ability to play tapes, cassettes?
Not easily, but I can probably find out.
No. If you don't... do you want this? These are the original. This is the way the set was sold. You have that back. If anyone wants this, it's yours for the asking. Morty, you want Yitzchak? Remind me to write it down. I'll see if I can find another one. Okay?
Can these be made into cassettes?
They are cassettes. That's what they are.
Or the cassette, I mean, can be made into this.
You don't have to. It's on the YU website. It's on the YU website. Next. This is a back issue of a magazine that did me great harm because it put Jewish Observer out of existence. And I love Jewish Observer because either I loved their articles or their articles were up because either I laughed or cried. But I never walked away paravdik. And Mishpacha took over the world. And here they have an article on this Satmar guru. And here's his assistant, David Katz, who taught me how to use a computer. So this is my Rebbe. He was my Talmud in the Kollel and my Rebbe as to computers. If anyone wants this issue, you're welcome to it. Anyone who's teaching in Israel or will be teaching or be in Chinuch, this is Midei Chodesh B'Chodesho put out by the Masrad HaChinuch. It gives you fabulous information on each month. This, once again, is dealing with Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and how to present them to students that are secular students in the state of Israel. I believe with that I have accomplished everything, and I want to thank you very much for coming, and to all those listening across the big, wide expanse of the world, all the way to Perth, Australia, until we meet again in health and happiness. Das Vedanya.
Perth is all the way in the other end.
I got a correspondence from there, so that's why I mentioned it.
All the way.
Yeah, I know.
This is from Ellie Wagner.
Okay, Ellie.